firework thoughts. A dialogue of dead leaves underfoot, our social cues like twiggy trees kaput. This conversation of a wood at night, so different from a highway during light. Stop thinking in fucking iambic pentameter, Malone. I follow Walt, the peculiar wayfarer, uphill. After 20 minutes or so, the ground begins to level a bit. 5 minutes later, the trees diminish, and I suddenly understand a lot more about the kid's situation. In the middle of a circular clearing, a ragged blue tent stands like an emphysema patient. Its withering canvas is bent, torn, faded, and ripped. Beside a dead campfire, a cornucopia of pots and pans pours out of an overturned milk crate. Wet t-shirts dangle from bony branches around the edges of the clearing advertising roofing companies, church soccer leagues, and obscure rock bands. A shallow pit full of feces permeates the clearing from 10 yards away. I don't know whether I'm relieved or terrified by the box of toilet paper next to it. Never, I think, raising my shirt collar up over my nose. Not in 1 million years. Literally 1 million. I would hold it for 1 million years. It's my land! New Chicago! Says Walt, disappearing inside his tent. Putting some distance between the shit pit and myself, I climb atop a boulder the size of a smart car. What with my depth perception, it takes a few tries, but I manage eventually. Far below, the occasional flickering headlight is the only sign of human life. It certainly feels isolated up here, like some post-apocalyptic zombie movie. Through the thinning fall trees, I squint my good eye until the headlights blur into luminous stars, cosmic proof of the outside world. It spins and spins, ignorant of more than just this kid's mountaintop campsite. It's ignorant of the kid himself. I know this is true because the Subaru lady didn't stop for Walt. She stopped for me. Ready to swim? Walt looks up at me with wide-eyed enthusiasm. He's shirtless now, holding a flashlight and sporting a pair of cut-off Daisy Dukes. The Cubs hat and the green chucks he's still wearing, as well as that infectious smile that sets my heart aflame. It's the same smile my dad and I used when we made waffles, only Walt's is magnified somehow, like I don't know what, the Belgian waffle version or something. Here, he says, offering a wad of denim. My backup pair. Hopping down from the boulder, I take the shorts and hold them out in front of me. They're a little wide in the waist and far shorter than any shorts I've ever worn. Walt throws his finger in the air, spins on his heels. This way to my pool! He stomps through the woods, bare-chested, peach-fuzzed, and pale-thighed, laughing his ass off, throwing that index finger in the air, and I have to give it to him. This kid has absolutely nothing in the world to call his own, and look how happy he is. No family? No friends? No home? No sweat? Hey, hey, he's Walt, and he's alive, and that's enough. In light of his situation, my problems suddenly seem brazenly adolescent, like a spoiled child crossing her arms and demanding some expensive new toy. I follow him to the other side of the shit pit where a murky lake awaits. Walt props the flashlight against a rock, then throws his arms open as if, ta-da, presenting a vaudeville show. The water is beyond brown. It reminds me of the rusty shat fluids that poured from my old greyhound like a hose. Dysenteric concerns aside, I wonder who actually owns this land. If some deadly Amazonian bacterial disease doesn't get me, a bullet courtesy of the land's proper owner might. I open my mouth to say, sorry, buddy, you're on your own. Yet somehow the words that come out are, give me a minute. I step behind a tree and quickly pull off my hoodie, shoes, socks, and jeans. WT fucking F, Malone. This is nuts, and I know that, but for some reason I can't stop laughing. I don't know what it is, but slipping on the Hoochie Mama shorts, I almost fall over due to uncontrollable laughter. I step out from behind the tree to find Walt in the middle of the lake, splashing himself in the face, acting like a goofball. What happened to your leg? He asks, suddenly looking very concerned. I was in a bus accident, I say, still giggling, but I'm okay. The bus had an accident? He asks, climbing up onto the opposite bank. It flipped on the highway, but I'm fine, really. Just a scratch. Walt, apparently satisfied, backs up a few paces and throws his finger in the air. This is how you do it, okay, Mim? Like this, watch! He charges the lake with the ferocity of a Civil War captain leading his men into combat. But also, and if possible, more so, like a lanky 5-year-old who just discovered what his arms and legs are for. It's awkward, fumbly, and beyond beautiful. A few yards from the water's edge, he trips over his own feet and rolls haphazardly into the lake. His head pops up out of the water like an apple. Ha ha! Did you see that, Mim? That was pretty good, huh? Okay, your turn. I take a few steps back, wondering if there's anything I wouldn't do for this kid right now, even if he did steal my war paint, and hurl myself into the murky depths. The water is surprisingly refreshing inside and out. After all that smiling and laughing, my mouth hurts, but I don't care, because I'm here with Walt, enjoying the young fun now. Mom would love this kid. After a brief splash fight with Walt, because duh, I float on my back, letting the lake seep between my fingers and toes. The moon is young but bright, and for a moment I stare at it with my good eye. You're going to help your mom, Walt whispers. It's not a question. He's floating about 10 feet away, looking right at me through the dusky light. It's not creepy or anything, just intense. Ricky used to do the same thing. How do you know that, Walt? He dips his head under the water, leaving me in complete suspense. After resurfacing, he wipes his eyes and smiles at me. I heard you while you were asleep, under the bridge. Great. What else did I say? Something, something, fireworks, he says softly. Then other somethings. I don't know. I have firework thoughts, too. Now it's my turn to go under. Dipping my choppy hair back, I push my sopping bangs out of my eyes and turn my head from Walt. So the kid heard my big things after all. I understand, he whispers. Your mom needs you, and you need her. There are times when talking just pushes out the tears. So I float in silence, watching the final touches of this perfect moonrise, and in a moment of heavenly revelation, it occurs to me that detours are not without purpose. They provide safe passage to a destination, avoiding pitfalls in the process. Floating in this lake with Walt is most certainly a detour. And maybe I'll never know the pitfalls I've avoided, but I can say this with certainty. A sincere soul is damn near impossible to find. And if Walt is my detour, I'll take it. In fact, I wouldn't be one bit surprised to hear him use the word pizzazz in a sentence. I close my good eye and see myself as I might look from above, as I might look to a mosquito hovering over a hot lake. I see Mim, her face pallid and feeble, her skin pale and glistening, her bones brittle and twiggy, an army of trees surrounding her. She floats next to a boy she met only hours ago, missing her mother, missing her old life, missing the way things used to be. Now she is crying because even after all that laughter, she can't shake that feeling, one of the worst in the world. I am tired of being alone. You need help? Walt's quiet voice brings me back to the now, the real, the detour. I, Mary Iris Malone, smile at the bright new moon. Wiping away my tears, I wonder if things are finally changing. Yeah, Walt, I might.
Chapter 18. Caleb. When it comes to my war paint, my circle of trust is sparse. Non-existent, really. There is no circle. Up until the bus accident, it had been a complete secret. And maybe it still is. Between the weight of imminent death followed by the rush of having succeeded where others have failed, and there really is no kind of success like survival. It's possible the passengers had issues more pressing than that of Mim Malone walking among the wreckage wearing lipstick on her face like Athena, goddess of war. I sure hope so. Because the idea of Poncho Man witnessing that side of me is enough to make me rip my bangs out by the root. Who are we fighting? No one, Walt. Hold still. In the light of a crackling campfire, I cup Walt's face in my hands and induct him into my uber-exclusive club. Though without the lipstick, which must be in that blue tent of his, I'm forced to use mud. Luckily, there's no shortage. There, I say, topping off his two-sided arrow with a dot in the middle. Done. He smiles and laughs and does a little jig around the campfire. You want me to do you now, Mim? No thanks, buddy. I can manage. I dip my finger in the soft mud and with the precision of a surgeon apply the makeshift war paint. It's my first time without a mirror, but as it turns out, I have superior muscle memory. Once done, I grab another tin of ham and sprawl in front of the fire, feeling more Mim than ever before. The two of us sit with mud-painted faces, eating like the king and queen of I don't know what. Ham-a-lot, I suppose. Walt belches, then covers his mouth and laughs uncontrollably. And I'm wondering who I need to see about protecting that laugh as the eighth wonder of the world. Its echo finally subsides as he pulls out his Rubik's Cube. I like our mosquito makeup, he says softly. I imagine the state of Mississippi crumbling, then sinking into the Gulf, just like in my dream, leaving naught but an army of vengeful mosquitoes. What? Happily working on his cube, Walt points to his face and says, It's a mosquito. And he's right. These lines I've spent hours perfecting, vertically from forehead to chin, the two-sided arrows on either cheek, then a horizontal one just above the eyebrows, could easily be the outline of a mosquito. An anemic stick figure mosquito, but a mosquito nonetheless. Do you like the ham? He asks between clicks. Still processing the fact that I've been drawing a mosquito this whole time, I don't answer. I bought it with my father money, he says. Your what? I ask in a fog. My father money. He gave it to me before sending me to Charlotte. It's in a secret hiding spot with my shiny things. I don't know which part of his story to WTF. Wait, yes I do. Walt, your father sent you to Charlotte? Head down, he works silently on his Rubik's Cube. In no time flat, the red cubes are aligned. Walt, where's your dad? He looks up at the sky for a moment, lost in thought. Walt? Chicago, he says, turning back to his cube. The green ones are lined up. Hey, hey, green are good. As direct as possible, I try again. Why aren't you living with your dad, Walt? He's twisting and clicking and all out ignoring me. I consider what he said earlier about his mother being in a casket. If his father was left alone to take care of a kid with Down syndrome, God, surely he didn't just hand money to his kid and send him packing. Walt can't be more than 15, 16 tops. The Cubs are in Chicago, he says, white squares intact. They're good. They're my favorite. Poor kid. I don't have the heart to tell him, on top of everything else, his favorite baseball team is the absolute worst. Yeah, Walt, those Cubbies are something else. Yeah, man, he says, shaking his head. Those Cubbies are something else. We should go to a game sometime, but we have to get tickets first. He throws his finger in the air. Tickets. What are you guys talking about? The shadow behind Walt could have been there 5 seconds or an hour. It's creepy, but creepier still. Walt isn't fazed. He doesn't jump, doesn't look up from his Rubik's Cube, isn't startled in the slightest. The owner of this new voice steps from the trees like a cautious predator. He's tall, Freakishly so. And wearing a red hoodie like mine.
Cubbies, Caleb, says Walt. We're talking about the Cubs.
The kid called Caleb grabs a tin of ham and plops down next to Walt. Sticking the edge of the can between his teeth, he pops it open.
Walt, what have I told you about the Cubs?
Walt frowns, finishing off the blue squares.
The Cubs suck balls.
Caleb nods and takes a giant bite.
Right on, the Cubs suck balls, dude. Always have, always will, you follow?
I am suddenly aware of my lack of clothing. For some reason, I hadn't minded the Daisy Dukes in front of Walt, but with this new kid? Well, I'm not about to stand up and walk around in these short cutoffs and a soaking wet t-shirt. I pull the blankets up around my legs, covering as much as I can.
What do you guys got on your face?
Says Caleb, staring at me from across the fire. Suck a duck. I forgot about the war paint. My circle of trust, it seems, is ever expanding.
Nothing, I say, trying to think up an excuse. We were just... nothing.
Caleb nods and smiles, his teeth full of processed ham. There's something about his voice, smile, smell, clothes, hair, hook nose, and shifty eyes that makes me about as uncomfortable as a nun in a whorehouse, as my mom used to say. He's sitting right here in front of me, a physical being, but hand to God, Caleb feels more like a shadow than a person. He pulls a pack of cigarettes from his pocket, sticks one in his mouth, along with the canned ham, and lights up.
You were just nothing, huh?
Now he's talking, on top of chewing and smoking.
Real eloquent there, sweetheart.
My name's Mim, jackass. I pull the blanket up close to my chin and imagine myself in a small room alone with Caleb. He's tied down, and I have one pair nunchucks, one pair katanas, one pair size, and one bow staff. I am Mim, the lost turtle in a half shell. He tosses a half-eaten canned ham into the woods and gets up to grab a new one.
Okay then, Mim, jackass. Sounded like you guys were having a real nice discussion about moms and dads and roses and rainbows and shit. Now, my old man, he was a real creative son of a bitch. Used to beat the hell out of me with household appliances, you follow? Irons, pots, pans, toasters, and the like. For no good reason, too. He wasn't a drunk, which I guess would have been a reason. Thing is, he didn't need a drink to be hateful, you follow? He was just fine at it sober. But one day, I was all growed up, see? So you know what I did? Pulled the fire extinguisher out of his garage and beat the shit out of him.
Caleb howls, tossing his second can into the woods. I'm beginning to wonder if he isn't my exact opposite. A violent, smoking moron who throws tin cans into nature. His laugh morphs into a hacking cough, reminiscent of old Arlene's respiratory issues. The main difference being, she was ancient, and he can't be more than 18.
So the state sent me to live with foster parents,
Caleb continues, having pulled it together.
Second night I'm there, my foster dad, a guy named...
He taps his chin with his finger, but I can tell it's an act. He knows the guy's name, or else he's making it up.
Raymond, that's it. Raymond raises a fist, but I'd had enough of that, see? Out of the frying pan, as they say.
Caleb puts down his spoon, then peers across the fire at me, eyes ablaze.
I stabbed that son of a bitch right there in his kitchen.
I swear it's a shadow. A talking, eating, smoking, cursing shadow. Walt stands up, fidgets with his spoon, puts it in his pocket, then walks toward the tent.
I'll get blankets.
For a moment, Caleb and I are alone. I avoid eye contact by studying the dirt. Don't look up. The sound of Walt rustling around in the tent mixes with the fire's crackling, which mixes with my heart pounding, which mixes with my blood pumping, which mixes with. I look up. Through the dying flames, Caleb is staring at me. And I'm reminded of the familiar nothingness of an old television set. Growing up, my dad refused to buy a new TV. The colors in the corners of the screen were beginning to fade, a promise that before long every movie would be black and white. But here's what I remember most. That old television, when turned off, produced a little click just as the screen went blank. And within that click, the stories and characters of my shows were swept away as if they'd never existed at all. In Caleb's eyes, I see that old television turned off, like the shows never existed. September 2, late at night. Dear Isabel, topics of substance and despair abound. They're sprouting up all over the place, in fact. To wit, I just met someone who scares the shit out of me. As I write this, he's sleeping, I think, hope, pray, on the other side of a campfire, so I need to be quiet and quick. Here's the thing. This person reminds me of a terrible feeling I once had, and it's one of those terrible feelings that might not be as bad as I remember it. So I need to write it down, because sometimes writing a thing down is a good way to work something out. So here goes. 3 straight birthdays, I snuck out of the house with my friend Henry Timoney to the Retro Movieplex. Henry and I first became friends in the school library, where we each noticed the other reading a Crichton Collection copy of Jurassic Park. Our relationship gained traction when Henry berated the movie for allowing Mr. Hammond to escape Isla Nublar alive. I, being a rationally minded literary purist, agreed. However, I voiced my opinion that what the film lacked in the way of subtle nuances and erudite accuracy, it more than made up for in special effects, cinematography, and Jeff Goldblum goodness. Henry, being a rationally minded cinematic purist, agreed. My parents, film rating sticklers that they were, had no idea I'd taped over their Carol Burnett marathon when Jurassic Park was aired during a free trial of HBO. I'd been watching it in secret for years.
"You sure know a lot about Jurassic Park," said Henry, "for a girl."
"I know a lot about a lot of things," I said, "for anybody." Henry nodded and straightened his glasses, and we quickly became what we'd always be. Friends by default. Now, as fate would have it, Retro Movieplex, a theater that only aired older movies, happened to be showing Jurassic Park that very weekend, the weekend of my 11th birthday. But as the film was rated PG-13, there was no way my parents would allow me to go. So Henry and I developed a foolproof plan. It began with my sneaking out the front door after dinner while my parents watched the nightly news. Henry's big brother, a meathead named Steve, had a friend who worked at the theater and had agreed to sell us tickets even though we were underage. Steve would be our ride to and from the theater. I was sexually attracted to Steve in so much as I was an indiscriminate pre-adolescent girl. Was he good-looking? Sure. Very. Extremely. But no amount of hotness could make up for his constant misuse of the word literally, overuse of the word bra, and downright baffling pronunciation of the word library. As in, "Check it, brah, I literally died yesterday in the library when..." Alas, I was 11, and he was devastatingly male. My hands were tied. Lack of subtle nuances and erudite inaccuracies notwithstanding, Jurassic Park was 10 times better on the big screen, and by the time it was over, Henry and I vowed never to criticize the film again. On the way home, I sat in the back seat of Steve's Jetta, and while he navigated the snowy streets of downtown Ashland, I navigated the ripple of muscle at the base of his neck. Yeah, okay, that's weird, but I'm being honest here. Before I ever knew about sex, it knew about me. As the car rounded into my driveway, I saw the light in the den turn on, and in that instant, I knew I was in trouble. Steve and Henry wished me luck as I walked inside. My parents were waiting on the couch, cross-legged and tongue-tied. Mom got up and clicked the TV off. No need for conversational details. I had walked right into the thick air of punishment. Grounded. 1 week. On my 12th birthday, my theatric insubordination paid dividends to the tune of Highlander 2, The Quickening. I have to say, my parents could have saved their punishment on this one, as the movie was punishment enough. Blimey. Afterward, sexy Steve drove us home, and as I was a year older, new images sprang to mind. Less boxing ring chest pounding, more bedroom floor topless romping. And upon pulling into my icy driveway, I was not at all surprised to find the den light on. Steve and Henry wished me luck, I went inside and another week grounded. For my 13th birthday, we chose The Shining, which messed me up for weeks. Afterwards, Steve drove us home, and as I was now 13, I saw through the bullshit. Sexually speaking, Steve was dead to me. As he made the turn onto my street, I geared myself up for a grounding. Sneaking out to a bad movie, having goofy fun with Henry, riding home with Steve, then getting caught. At the time, I wouldn't have admitted this, but the getting caught was just as much a part of my birthday tradition as anything else. But on this night, the den lights were off. Climbing out of the Jetta, both Steve and Henry congratulated me on finally getting away with it. I nodded in a daze and walked inside. The TV was on in the empty den, but muted. No one was awake. No one was mad. No one cared. My God, I hope you don't know what that feels like. Signing off. Mary Iris Malone. Friend by default. P.S. I wish I hadn't written this down. Chapter 19. The Talismans of Disappointment. I wake up in cutoffs, mud caked to my face, and a roaring stomach ache. The moan, which started in my toes, then wriggled its way through my veins and arteries, organs and muscles, all the way to my lungs, almost escapes. But the kinetic power of a moan is nothing compared to the willpower of a mim. It's the kind of middle of the night you feel in your bones. I don't know what time it is, but my bones tell me it's somewhere between 2 and 4 a.m. As I sit up, the journal topples off my chest. I stick it back in my bag, slip on my high tops, and creep off toward the shit pit. Congrats again, universe. Yours is a suspiciously acute sense of humor. Circling the dying embers of the campfire, I notice Caleb's empty bedding. But in the slipstream of such indigestion, it seems almost trivial. In fact, nothing means much of anything right now other than the immediacy of my bellowing bowels and a permanent embargo on canned ham. After the silencing of the bellows, well, things begin to mean things again. And Caleb's empty bedding is a definite something. Before I have a chance to guess what, I hear a noise just outside the clearing. I freeze. Quiet. Listening. At some point during my time in New Chicago, my ears acclimated to the echoing cacophony of birds chirping, leaves cracking, twigs snapping, the natural sounds of autumnal nature. I shut my good eye and sift through these noises like a 49er panning for gold. Yes, there. Right there. Definite whispers. I creep toward the edge of the clearing. Spidery trees and wispy branches, dead leaves crackling like old parchment, and a moonlight subdued. Middle-of-the-night forest is one creepy-ass place. I follow the soft speech toward an oak. At its base, a single shadow, tall and wiry, turns sideways, talking animatedly to someone just out of sight. I squat down on my hands and knees, sinking my knuckles into the soft dirt, willing the sound of my breath away. There are two distinct voices.
That's the plan. Get the whole stash, though. None of this half-ass horseshit.
What about the girl?
Asks Caleb. After our little campfire story time, I'd recognize his voice anywhere.
Sweetheart's a liability, ain't she?
They're talking about me.
She's kinda cute, says Caleb, even with the mud.
The moon is just bright enough to see Caleb's outline, but from this angle, I can't make out the second person.
Keep your eyes on the prize, Caleb. That girl gets in our way, we'll just have to take care of her. You can do that, right?
A brief pause. The second voice has a strange, guttural quality, as if the person is eating cake while talking.
Caleb?
What?
The second person makes a noise like he's spitting or something, then says,
If the girl gets in our way, I need to know you will take care of her.
My heart is at an Olympic pace.
Yes,
whispers Caleb.
I will. Good. We're close now, you feel it?
Holding my breath, I inch closer and picture what I must look like. Lurking in the dark woods wearing these ridiculous cutoffs, my hair matted in clumps from the murky lake,
and to top it off, my muddy war paint, acting as true camouflage.
Yeah, 400 more should do the trick. Well, shit. The kid's gotta have that and then some stashed away. Now remember, last time we tried, he had the cash tucked down in the bottom of his sleeping bag. So we'll check there, plus the suitcase.
I'm closing in now, circling around through leaves and brush. It's slow going, but any faster and I lose the stealth factor. I need the stealth factor. The stealth factor is crucial.
You and I have had enough trouble out here to last two lifetimes, see? What we need is a fresh start. Beaches and girls and, who knows, might even get us a job in the movies. Shit, our story is probably worth millions. Probably billions, says Caleb. You're an idiot sometimes, you know that? Nothing's worth billions. Anyway, millions is plenty.
Fingertips to forehead, I am caked in sweat. I crouch as low as possible, move quickly, quietly, efficiently, dart around the final tree, then duck and roll behind a prickly fern. I can already tell my stealthy instincts have not led me astray. I'm in prime vantage point, the perfect position to see who Caleb is talking to. Still holding my breath, I peer around the fern.
I could be a writer, he says. I've always wanted to write.
My skin crawls as Caleb contorts his face, answers himself.
Yeah, we'll write it ourselves. More money that way.
Now back to his original face and voice.
Sure, more money, but it might open other doors, see? For other projects.
I close my eyes, willing this to be a dream. In some miraculous sonic anomaly, I hear the voice of my father, miles and miles away, whispering in my ear.
Here we have a rare first-hand account of the Schneiderian first-rank symptoms of schizophrenia. Thought echo, voices heard arguing, voices heard commenting on one's actions, delusions of control, thought withdrawal, thought insertion, thought broadcasting, and delusional perception.
Suddenly I'm in the living room back in Ashland, playing bank teller, doing the voices of both the teller and the customer.
Something's wrong with her, Evie.
Eyes still closed, I grip the fern for balance. It pierces my palm. A shriek pulls me from the memory.
Who's there?
Says Caleb. The shriek was my own. Now it's Mom's turn to whisper in my ear. Run, Mary. Turning, I goodwill myself through the woods, darting past trees, hurtling limbs and branches. I am Arrow Iris Malone, Olympic record holder in the wooded sprint, running straight and true, striking at the heart of my prey, the clearing. I burst through the line of trees, dive into my bedding, pull the blanket up to my chin and close my eyes. Caleb approaches, crashing his way through the woods, his lanky gait wrecking the pureness of the soundscape. And I am struck, now more than ever, at what an unnatural person he is. His footsteps crunch and crackle, closer, closer. He can't be more than a few feet away now. They stop, just by my head. Eyes closed, heart pounding. I am a statue. Minutes pass. He's standing there, I know it, waiting for me to make the first move. Fake sleeping in front of a psychopath in the middle of the woods is, believe it or not, harder than it sounds. I pray that my right eye is actually closed and will my breath to slow. My hand, which landed on my chest when I dove into bed, is rising and falling with each breath. The external sounds of the forest dissipate. The internal sounds of my body swell. He's there. I know it. Don't move, Mary. I used to lie in bed with my hand on my heart, just like I am now, and listen to my parents fight. That's when I discovered something. With extreme concentration, I could hear my own insides over the sound of Mom and Dad's yells. Blood coursing through veins, muscles stretching and creaking. Sometimes I could even hear my hair growing. It was bizarre, no doubt. But the worst by far was the amplification of my heartbeat. I would hear that sucker pounding and pounding, and consider all the things I hadn't done, and all the things I didn't even know about not doing, and all the heartbreaks I would never experience, the ones that led to love and everything else. And what if right there, what if right here, right now, I actually hear my heart stop beating, beating,
beating, beating. Caleb hasn't budged. His uncomfortable nearness is palpable. Each breath, in and out, rising, falling. I think of those days long ago, lying in bed, terrified not of the yelling but of what the yelling meant. And here's what I learned. It's impossible to wonder when your heart will stop beating, without wondering if that time is now.
No coffee. This is my first thought upon waking. I am alive.
A close second.
I rub the fall air from my eyes, willing my brain to get its wheels out of the mud. Morning, honey.
Across the campfire, Caleb sits in all his shadowy glory, a cigarette hanging from one side of his mouth, a spoon of ham from the other. He pulls a tin from the box and offers it to me.
I vomit in my mouth, swallow, shake my head. More for me, he mutters.
Shivering, I sit up and pull the blankets around my shoulders. I must have fallen asleep while I was pretending to be asleep. Pretty damn effective, I'd say.
How do you sleep?
The corners of Caleb's mouth curl into a faint smile.
Like a log,
I lie.
You? Same.
I scan the clearing quickly, avoiding Caleb's shifty eyes.
Where's Walt? Shit pit,
he mumbles, chews, puffs. I see him glance toward the tent and wonder if he's already made a pass at Walt's money. I'm guessing not, or he wouldn't be here. He's trying to figure out what to do with me. I grab my backpack and rummage around for the makeup remover pads, eager to be rid of last night's war paint. Mud or not, the pad should do the trick. Unfortunately, they're at the bottom of the bag, forcing me to acknowledge my many talismans of disappointment. One wooden box, wherefore art thou, Ahab? One cell phone, 39 missed calls. One bottle of abilitol, if habit is king, I'm the joker. One terse letter, think of what's best for her, please reconsider. And last, but certainly not least, one Hills Brothers coffee can. Behold, the mistress of burgling. A morning of harsh disappointments tends to slide down the gullet a little easier with some fresh Java behind it. But as New Chicago seems to be heavy on the tainted meats and light on the gourmet beans, I'm forced to swallow my disappointments as they come. I locate the makeup remover and begin wiping the caked mud off my face.
You know, says Caleb.
His cigarette is now a stump. Sucking down the last of its juices, he flicks it into the ashes of last night's campfire and looks up. His turned-off eyes stir a strange combination inside me, of both fight and flight. As if waiting for his sentence to finish itself, Caleb sits with his mouth open, the accusation there in spirit but not word. Not yet. The thing is, it doesn't have to be spoken. I can feign ignorance till I'm blue in the face, but I was there. I know the deep end of his soul's pool. I know Caleb's dark secret. Not who he is, but what. A shadow. A creepy-ass, golem, schizo-effing shadow.
Hey, hey, Mim!
Walt yells, bounding out of the woods, buttoning his pants. His face is still covered in dried mud. When he sees my clean face, he stops.
Is the war over?
Lord, bless and keep the house of Walt for all of eternity.
Sure is, Walt. Come here, let me clean you up.
Caleb tosses his bedding into the tent, his accusations dangling on the tip of his tongue.
Well, he yawns. I'm gonna take a shit in the pit and a wash in the lake. Walt, I got something I want to talk to you about when I get back.
Okay, Caleb. Then, looking at me, he winks.
You too, sweetie.
He retreats into the woods before I have a chance to give him my eat-shit squint. It's a dynamite squint, too, one I save for the purest of assholes. After cleaning Walt's face, I stick the pack of makeup remover back in my bag. My good eye lands on my bottle of abilitol, and for a split second, I imagine the shape of a great grizzly charging me head-on. I see its sharp claws, its glassy eyes, its lolling tongue. I catch my breath and stuff the bottle down in the bag. Fuck it, I can miss a day.
Hey, Walt, I say, a plan beginning to take shape. He's eating ham, like it's his first, last, and only, watching a bluebird tug a worm from the ground.
Yo, Walt,
I whisper. The bird seems desperate for its early, earthy breakfast. Walt is enthralled.
Hey, hey, he says, still staring at the bird.
You ever been to Cleveland?
His head turns from the carnivorous bird to me. In my ear, I hear my mother again.
Have a vision, Mary, unclouded by fear.
I have limited experience, but I know this. Moments of connection with another human being are patently rare. But rarer still are those who can recognize such a connection when they see one. The camera zooms in on Walt's piercing eyes. It cuts to a close-up of my own. The connection is there, wriggling below the surface, just like that worm. And what's more, we both feel it. In the distance, Caleb is splashing around, making a ridiculous racket. Walt looks toward the lake, then whispers,
"He won't like it."
May the house of Walt live forever and ever, amen. No, he won't, Walt. Chapter 20. Run, run, run. It feels nice to be out of those cutoffs and into some real clothes again. Downright delightful, actually. Pulling my repacked JanSport tight, I wrap one of Walt's extra blankets between the straps in my chest. The kid has spent the last few minutes packing one of those hard 50s-style suitcases full of canned hams, blankets, and God knows what else from that decrepit blue tent. Okay. I put my hands on his shoulders. We just need to get back to the overpass. We can get a ride from there, okay? Just stick close and... Suddenly, Walt raises an arm. In his hand, he's holding my mother's lipstick like a champion's torch.
I found your shiny, he says, avoiding eye contact.
I reach for it, but can't stop looking at Walt. The kid is about to cry. Thank you, Walt, I say, taking the lipstick in my hands. Without another word, he reaches his arms around my waist in a gentle hug. I'm surprised how natural it feels, as if a team of scientists designed his arms to fit the precise specifications of a heartfelt embrace. In his hug, I feel the things he tries to say but can't. I feel his pain and childlike innocence, his unencumbered joy and I don't know what. Life, I suppose. All the good things from the very best of places.
We need to get going,
I whisper, slipping the lipstick in my pocket. Caleb has gone quiet, conjuring all manner of nerve-wracking scenarios in my head. Walt straightens his Cubs cap, grabs his suitcase in one hand, his Rubik's Cube in the other, and leads the way down the hill. In an all-out sprint. The shrubbery is dense but doesn't slow him one bit. He's weaving in and out of bushes and trees with surprising agility. By contrast, I follow behind like an errant sled, haphazard and zigzagged. A minute later, I hear it, behind us, a third set of scurrying leaves. Walt must hear it too because he picks up the pace considerably.
Where are y'all running off to?
Caleb's voice comes in rasps. 10 paces ahead, Walt is absolutely hoofing it.
Mim?
He yells over his shoulder. I'm here, buddy! Keep going! Behind me, Caleb gasps like he wants to say something, but can't. Clearly, the cigarettes have taken their toll. His lungs are absolutely screaming for air. Unfortunately, he's not the only one wearing down. Either the after effects of last night's woeful sleep have kicked in or my youthful stamina is wavering. At the bottom of the hill, we hurdle the metal guardrail. It's early morning on a holiday weekend, so highway traffic is scarce. Right now, I would give all the cash in Kathy's can for a passing car, truck, van, just someone. My head droops, my backpack sags, my shoes lag, the slap-slap of their worn soles on asphalt growing slower with each passing step. Under the bridge, we sprint past the very spot where I met Walt. It was only yesterday, but God, it feels like a month ago. On the other side, Walt races around a miniature hill through a line of shrubs and bushes and into the gravel parking lot of the same derelict building I'd seen from the window of the Subaru. Off-white. The offest white there ever was. A single pump in the middle of the lot has a handwritten sign taped over the handle. 87 or bust. It's a gas station. Like a track star, Walt digs in on the homestretch. Even with that hard suitcase slamming against his knees, he reaches the front door at least 20 paces ahead of us. I watch him pull a set of keys from behind an ice machine, open the door, and step inside. Caleb is only feet behind me now. I will my burning legs through the entrance, hear Walt slam and lock the door behind me just as Caleb flings himself against the double-paned glass. And like that, the cool and collected Caleb is gone, replaced by some zombie-eyed maniac pounding his fists against the door, gasping for breath, raging bull mad. I turn in a circle, trying to catch my own breath. The gas station is dark and empty, still closed for the day.
Walt, what are we doing here?
Obeying, says Walt, bouncing on the heels of his feet.
He said run, run and let him know. When there's trouble, I have to let him know.
I take a second to catch my breath, letting Walt's bizarre statement sink in.
Who?
Walt bends at the waist, setting his suitcase and Rubik's Cube on the tile floor. He turns toward the refrigerated section, pulls out a Mountain Dew, pops the cap, takes a long swig, then wipes his mouth with the back of his sleeve.
The Karate Kid, he says.
Chapter 21, Rooftop Revelations.
Blimey, this kid's full of surprises.
The what?
Only it's more like, the hell you say? He looks at me with a blank expression, tilts his head like a dog.
Walt?
Nothing. At all.
And then, everything at once.
He tosses the empty 20-ouncer into a trash can, throws his suitcase over the checkout counter, hops over after it, and disappears around a back corner. Like I said, surprises. I throw my bag over the counter and jump it myself. These last couple days have been tough on my poor leg. At this rate, that cut will probably heal into some horrible disfigurement. Just add it to my list of medical oddities. Around the corner, I spot Walt's green chucks on the top rung of a ladder, now disappearing through a trap door in the ceiling.
Wait up, Walt!
Caleb has stopped banging on the front door, which is unsettling, to say the least. I picture him crawling like a snake through the ductwork, hissing, spitting, eagerly calculating an alternate point of entry. After scurrying up the ladder, I emerge through the same trap door and climb out onto the roof. It's still morning, but the sun is out in full force, beating down on the gravel and cement. Broad pipes, ventilation fans, and all manner of rusty eyesores sprout up like weeds every 5 feet or so. Planted right in the middle of the gas station roof is a massive tank. It's circular, like an above-ground pool, only taller. Standing at least 8 feet high, it takes up more than half the surface area of the roof.
Where is he, Al?
I follow Walt's voice around the side of the tank and find him standing next to a 340-pound whale of a man in aviator sunglasses. The guy is lounging shirtless in a folding chair, sipping an umbrella drink. He's frightfully pale, a condition magnified by dark oil stains smeared across his face. Layer after folding layer, his stomach hangs down over his swimming trunks.
Walt,
I point toward the fat guy. You see him too, right? The man's blubber shakes as he laughs. He sips his daiquiri through a crazy straw, looks from Walt to me.
Nah, I'm just a figment of your imagination, kid.
What? You were expecting a hookah-smoking caterpillar?
Walt, ignoring us both, bounces up and down on the heels of his feet.
Where is he, Al? Where is he?
I cross the roof, joining them in the partial shade of a fake palm tree, doing my best not to throw up on the pale whale's third circle of blubber.
Walt, we gotta get off this roof, man. We're sitting ducks up here.
Who the hell are you?
Asks the pale whale. An image from the most vivid quarters of my imagination. A car changing this man's oil. Mim, I say, all I can muster.
Ma'am?
He blurts.
What kind of name is that?
I find it hard to believe this man could criticize anybody's anything.
You find the bottom of that daiquiri yet? What is it, 8 a.m.?
I turn to Walt.
Listen, we don't have time for this. Caleb's insane. It's only a matter of time.
That's just bad manners, see?
Spinning, I see Caleb round the circular tank, holding a sizable hunting knife.
A trickle of blood drips from his hands onto the gravel roof. He coughs, then pulls a cigarette from his back pocket and lights it.
Sorry, Al. Had to bust a double-paned window to get in.
Inhaling, his eyes dart around.
Where's your boyfriend?
Gas station plus boyfriend.
Karate class in Union, says the pale whale, smacking his lips around the straw.
An odd smile spreads across Caleb's face. He steps closer, the sharp end of the hunting blade shimmering in the light of the morning sun.
Like a fucking 6-year-old, he mumbles.
Al pinches one nostril, blows snot out the other, just like a whale's blowhole. Sliding his meaty hands behind his head, he sighs, and for a moment it's quiet, as if none of us are entirely sure whose turn it is to talk. Then, with the subtlety befitting a man of his stature, Albert breaks the silence.
You're a freak show, you know that, Caleb?
The folding chair squeaks under his weight.
Seriously, you should sell tickets. People would come from miles around to see you talk to yourself. Speaking of which, when you do that, is it a natural, everyday sort of thing, like putting on socks?
Caleb's eyes twitch, but he doesn't answer.
I shouldn't make fun,
continues Albert, rubbing his aviators on the bottom of his shorts.
I suppose that's a brand of batshit crazy you just can't help.
Caleb stands frozen, blood still dripping from the cut on his hand. Al raises his daiquiri to his lips. A stubborn slice of strawberry gets stuck in the straw. He sucks harder, squeezing it like Augustus through the glass tube in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He swallows it down, tilts his head at Caleb. Like an old-fashioned pistol duel, it's not about who draws first, but who draws quickest.
Get the hell off my roof,
says Albert, each of his stomachs rising, falling. Caleb pulls back his shoulders, and once again I notice his red hoodie. The same as my own. I picture my abilitol in the bottom of my bag, shrouded in the darkness of its canvas tomb, screaming a promise of normalcy.
I'm not crazy, whispers Caleb, twirling the knife in his hands.
And suddenly, from months ago, my father's voice.
Here, Mim.
I take the bottle and roll my eyes.
Don't look at me like that, says Dad. I'm trying to help. Just get in the habit of taking one with breakfast every day. Habit is king.
I glance at the label on the bottle, wondering how it got this far.
Dad, I don't need them.
He pulls orange juice out of the refrigerator, pours a glass.
I need you to trust me on this, Mim. You don't want to end up like Aunt Isabel, do you?
That's when I know he's scraping the bottom of the barrel, searching for anything to get me to cooperate. Taking the glass from his hand, I pop a pill in my mouth and drown it down with the rest of his juice. Every last drop. I wipe my lips with the back of my hand, stare him dead in the face.
I'm not crazy.
Sure you're not crazy, Caleb, says the pale whale. You just keep living your little fantasy life, son. Lord knows I've been there.
He slaps his belly.
But damn it all, I wouldn't trade these rolls for your level of crazy. Not for all the rotisserie chickens in Kentucky. You know why? 'Cause at the end of the day, when my fat ass tumbles into its king-sized waterbed, I sleep like a baby. I know who I am.
Oh yeah?
Caleb twirls the knife again, arching one eyebrow unnaturally high.
And who are you?
Albert, the pale whale, sips his daiquiri, smacks his lips together, then leans back and sighs.
I'm Albert, motherfucker. Who are you?
As Caleb steps toward Albert, I grip the war paint in my pocket and picture the long blade piercing those layers of blubber. Gallons of fluid would gush from the wound like a fire hydrant, hidden arteries, having spent the last 2 decades being stretched and filled to their fullest capacity, would now be exposed, severed, freed from the heaviest of loads. The wailing, wailing mess would pool around his bloated ankles, gather under the folding chair, then rise up and up, lifting the Leviathan carcass off the roof, spinning him like a top and tossing him off the edge of his own broke-ass, off-white gas station. We'd be swept up in the blood flood, too, Walt and I, carried away like Noah's Ark, or rather, like the animals of Afterthought,
left to fend for themselves in the apocalyptic precursor to the rainbow. This is what I imagine, but it never happens. Just as Caleb reaches Albert's chair, a blurred figure plummets on top of him, knocking him to the ground. Within seconds, Caleb is back on his feet, wielding the hunting knife at this new adversary. At first glance, the man seems too ridiculous to be real. He's wearing a black strip of cloth around his forehead like a ninja, goggles, a long gold chain around his neck, a flowery wife beater, and a pair of shockingly familiar cut-off jeans. Dripping wet from head to toe, he's smiling like he's having a ball. Next to me, Walt claps while Albert chuckles and sips his drink.
Fuck him up, Ahab!
Never mind my epiglottis. My entire body flutters at this. It's him. It's them. The fight doesn't last more than a minute. In a roundhouse kick that would have made Jet Li proud, Arlene's legendary nephew sends Caleb's hunting knife sailing over the edge of the roof. With him disarmed, it's hardly a fight at all. A couple of hook-kick combos and graceful strikes to the chest, arms, and head, and Ahab has a whimpering Caleb trapped in a half-Nelson on the gravel roof.
Walt, says Ahab, dripping wet, smiling from ear to ear. Go downstairs, call the Independence Police Station. Ask for Randy, tell him to get his ass over here.
Walt giggles, runs around to the trap door.
You okay, honey?
Ahab looks up at Albert, leaving me to wonder at the sheer physics of their relationship.
I'm all right, grunts the pale whale. Thanks to my knight and shimmering armor.
Shining, I whisper, still gripping my war paint and trying to piece together the sequence of the last few minutes. Ahab notices me, seemingly for the first time.
Who are you?
That's ma'am, says Albert, slurping the last of his daiquiri, then pulling a brand new one out from under his chair.
I clear my throat. It's Mim, I say, rapping my knuckles against the side of the tank. What's this?
We call it the Pequod, says Ahab. Perfect place for a little sun and relaxation.
I raise my eyebrows. What? Inside? The pale whale chuckles and sips. Ahab tightens his grip on Caleb.
It's a pool, kid.
Looking from Ahab to the tank, I can't help but wonder what kind of people drink daiquiris and go swimming on top of gas stations at 8 a.m. on chilly fall mornings. But I'll thank the gods of, you know, whatever, that they do. Because I'd be dead right now without these two. Walt comes running around the tank. Pool. Whatever.
Randy's on his way, he says.
Good.
Ahab hoists Caleb to his feet.
You guys can hang downstairs till he gets here. He's a dick of a dick, so he'll probably want to take you down to the station for questioning out of sheer boredom. Don't say anything about the pool, okay? He'd find some city bylaw and have it removed.
Walt gives him a thumbs up, scurries down the rungs. I stand still for a moment, wondering if this is the right time. Certainly it's not how I pictured it happening.
What's up, ma'am?
I take a knee, unzip my JanSport, and produce Arlene's wooden box. For a second, no one says anything. Finally, Ahab says, "Where did you get that?" His question is quiet, not accusatory. "Arlene," I whisper. "Your aunt. I was on the bus with her. The one that crashed." Albert sits up in his chair and takes off his aviators. There's something in his eyes, some deep well of empathy.
What's wrong with everybody? Grunts Caleb, still in Ahab's clenches. It's just a box.
Without thinking twice, Ahab lifts Caleb up by his hoodie and punches him once, twice, three times in the face. Blood splatters across the gravel roof, as well as a single tooth. The look in Ahab's eyes isn't murderous. It's the look of a man who did what had to be done. Caleb drops to the ground unconscious. Considering the solemnity of the moment he interrupted, I'm thinking he got off pretty easy. Ahab is in front of me now, looking at the box, then at me, and I suddenly can't stop crying. It's crazy because Arlene was his aunt, not mine. I didn't know her all that well, not really. I didn't know her favorite color or movie, or what kind of music she liked, or if she preferred lakes to oceans. I didn't even know her last name. But maybe those aren't the things that channel love. Maybe the true conduit is more elusive than that. Maybe. And I think Ahab understands, because now his